Hello, and welcome to IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast, brought to you by Learning Essentials. Learning Essentials offers special education-based tutoring in your home by state-certified educators with advanced degrees in all areas of special education. IEP Essentials Pro Tips Podcast brings professionals together to educate and empower families navigating special education needs in the IEP process.
Welcome to Pro Tips Podcast, a podcast that explores all things related to neurodiverse learners. Thanks for joining us today. I'm your host, Wendy Taylor. Today, we are talking about special education and independent schools with Peter Braverman. Peter Braverman is a school consultant in the Washington, D.C. area. He helps families find options outside mainstream public school programs. Before launching his own firm, Peter spent 24 years working in independent schools in the Chicago and Washington, D.C. areas. Most recently, Peter was a middle school head, which is the independent school equivalent of a principal. He did this for 11 years. Peter helps families complete the process of applying to schools and school programs. He has helped applicants gain admissions to day schools, boarding schools, parochial schools, and public magnet schools. Hi, Peter. Welcome to our podcast.
Hi, Wendy. It's great to be here. Thank you for having me.
You bet. I'm thrilled that you could join us and talk about independent schools and transitions to independent schools, what those look like, especially through the lens of special education. And so you support a student and family with the decision to transition to a new learning environment. And by doing that, you're providing that of an individual attention, the firsthand knowledge of hundreds of educational opportunities. And you also provide the time to explore all those options for families, which is a great gift for all types of learners. Kind of to set our playing field or conversation field for today, what can independent schools offer neurotypical students?
Well, independent schools offer non-neurotypical students the same things that they offer most students. And I think most people are drawn to independent schools initially for small classes and specially trained teachers. But I think it's important for families to remember that this works both ways. The public school system is exactly that. It's a system. And a system comes with advantages and limits as well. So in the public schools, one of the advantages might be that there are accepted strategies for working with specific challenges, such as dyslexia, dyscalculia, or autism spectrum disorders. But all of those strategies rely on teachers who are well-trained and motivated and creative themselves. And that's because the efficacy of a class is always about the teacher in that class. So if a particular teacher is highly skilled in working with kids who have profiles with which that teacher is comfortable, then the teacher may have an easier time working outside a system to find new and creative and individualized approaches that turn out to be successful. As the question you asked implies, though, there are limits. Many teachers are not trained in independent schools in dealing with non-neurotypical learning profiles, or that they believe that they shouldn't be required to venture too far outside accepted mainstream approaches, if you will. There are also some independent schools that will still deny that they enroll any students who are non-neurotypical, even though I think that position kind of strains credibility. And teachers can be sensitive to the limits of their skills, as we all are. So when we don't know how to do something, we may be insecure and defensive, which is obviously not a good way to approach a child with a learning challenge. And teachers in independent schools who haven't been specifically trained within the system may find that to be a limiting factor. Every independent school as a whole has a range of skills that its faculty bring with them. And if that collective range in the entire school doesn't include skills in teaching reading to dyslexic kids, for example, that school isn't likely to be a good match for a student with that profile. But if the school faculty does encompass that range of skills, then small classes and the ability to turn very quickly in a classroom environment may be really great advantages to a kid and a family who present with that kind of profile.
And that makes a lot of sense. And it really, you know, if I was a parent or families that have a child identified with learning needs, and it can be overwhelming to try to determine what would be the best fit, what would really help my child learn the skills and strategies to enhance and help them grow. And so with that, you have that insight knowledge to share with families to help guide them as to what would be the best fit for their individual student versus a trial and error, so to say, for different families. So if I had a child that was identified with a learning need, how would an independent school read that neuropsych testing?
Well, I think it depends on the school, obviously. And as I said earlier, different groups of people, different groups of teachers will bring a different overall skill set. When I was a division head, which is the independent school equivalent of a principal, the first question I always asked when I had a new evaluation was, does this report help me understand the child that I see every day in school? Does it illuminate the challenges a student is facing and help me understand the neurological bases for those challenges? And in almost every case, the report does do that. In the unusual cases where the report seemed a little harder to understand, our school's learning specialist and I would generally arrange for a conversation with the evaluator after seeking a release from the parents, of course. I also looked at the recommendations at the end of the report. I can understand the data and the testing, but in the end, the report is most useful to a school because it describes ways that the school can serve a student best. And I always needed to see whether those recommendations were reasonable. And I often passed judgment, that sounds like a horrible thing these days to pass judgment, on whether the evaluator seemed to understand the way that school works. So it seems like a great idea to ask teachers to make their notes available to a student after class each day, but that's not really the way most teachers work. So the recommendations can convey to me whether the evaluator has a realistic understanding of what's possible. And sometimes the recommendations indicate that psychologists want the best for their clients without recognizing that some of those strategies may be difficult or even impossible to implement in a certain school setting. I don't want to slam evaluators. Almost every single one of them in our area does a great job and helps schools to understand their students and parents to understand their children. It was rare for me to review an evaluation that didn't give me insights into the struggles that a student faced.
And I think that's important to say because as a family comes, they're feeling, you know, lots of feelings in terms of what's the best way to approach the independent school, which is the best way to share that information, that neuropsych testing is really a in-depth view of that child, their learning profile. And so, you know, talking about what you would glean from that testing as an independent school and looking at would this student fit nicely with the profile of the students and families that we have here and the ability to support that family. And so you talking about the recommendations, you know, what can you do with them, what you can't do. Oftentimes we look at recommendations, you say, oh, this is nice to know, this is what we need to know, and this might not work for our school. And at what point do you have that honest conversation, you know, whether it's on the consultant side, whether it's on the school side with the family to say, you know, you have these recommendations that come to us. At what point are we having that honest conversation of what works best, what might not work best?
I think that's a really important question. And let me take it in, I guess, the reverse order from how you asked. I think as a consultant, one of the things I can do is I can speak the language both of parents and of schools. And in a lot of these cases, parents and schools and evaluators are speaking slightly different languages. So being a parent and a former school administrator myself, I think that I bring an ability to translate those phrases or those senses of what a kid is like from one community to another. For years, I've had in my head, decades, I've had in my head a New Yorker cartoon that has never actually been drawn. And in the cartoon, all 20 students in the class have undergone neuropsych evaluations, which means that all 20 of them are sitting in the front row, because that's the most common recommendation in any report is front row placement. So kidding aside, I think it's a really good question because schools are different. Each school is different. And even within a school, people will approach different learning profiles in different ways. So as I implied a few minutes ago, I think it's not usually possible for any school to implement every recommendation that comes from an evaluator. And parents who expect that number 1 through 15 are all going to change in a school are probably going to be disappointed. So in most cases, what teachers and I could realistically implement was somewhere between a third and a half of the recommendations in a given report. I think what parents have a right to expect is that the relevant people at school will review the report with them and sometimes with the evaluator. And the people who attend that kind of review are generally negotiated between the division head or the learning specialist and the parents. And they'll just have a conversation, you know, whom are we going to invite to this meeting? So at my last school, a review would generally include a learning specialist and maybe a homeroom teacher or the advisor of the student. In many cases, I would also attend. And if it worked and it was indicated, we'd also ask other teachers to attend if it would be productive. I don't want to make this sound too mechanical. Parents whose kids have been evaluated often feel anxious about the process, and understandably so. It's a little nerve-wracking to be told why your kid is functioning the way they are. And I think to gather information is one of the things we do to hold our anxiety at bay. And so parents often would come to me with kind of an all hands on deck approach. We need all seven teachers in the room, and we need the coaches, and we need everything, every person who interacts with my child. But it's important really to consider that more isn't always better. And I was always, in my best days, I was really focused on what would be most effective. So it's harder to schedule a meeting with the division head, the learning specialist, and all seven teachers and two coaches than it is to schedule that meeting with a streamlined group. And the truth is, the teachers usually do a really good job of communicating to each other. And so parents can usually trust that the homeroom teacher or the English teacher or whichever teacher is in the meeting will convey what happened in the meeting to others. So I think it's really good for parents to want to get to a meeting with the school to understand the school's response and the school's interpretation of a neuropsych report. It's often important to remember as well that the most effective and efficient meeting is not the one attended by the most people, but the one that can get done quickly and get the information to the people who need it most effectively. So that was the way we tried to work with a neuropsych report that was new to families. And I think it's important for parents to expect that a school is going to work with them to achieve the goal of discussing the reports, discussing the recommendations, understanding which recommendations are practical, and then disseminating that information to other people at school who have a need to know those things. That requires a lot of good faith on everybody's part, but it's usually pretty effective when the school can make suggestions to parents and the parents can accept that a lot of the school's processes are honed over a number of years, so are likely to work for most families, and then adjustments would be made where necessary. Does that answer your question?
Well, it does. And, you know, and it's so important. You talk about that collaboration piece between home and school is really critical for all learners. And how nice is it to have somebody that can be that interpreter, that can speak the language of parents, that can help the school translate the needs of the student so that everybody can come to the table and really work and create and support the student in the best way that's possible within that environment. And I think it's also fair for parents to know that not every accommodation that's listed on that report will integrate smoothly and make the most sense to implement 20 at once. Oftentimes that can be overwhelming as well, right? So it may not just be the school and trying to figure out what the accommodations are, the training of the teacher, and how we can implement those accommodations and modifications within the curriculum in the classroom, but also, you know, what makes most sense for that learner, not to overwhelm, but really make the most sense to enhance that learning for that student. And for you to be a liaison or to have a consultant be the liaison is just a really smooth way to help that process and really to make it effective for all. And, you know, and at the heart of all of this, like you said, you know, we all want the best for the students that we're supporting, you know, for our own students that we may have, our own children we may have. So we all want it to be effective and support their learning and growth process. So when we look at independent schools, you know, you hear the term equitable services. And what does that relate and how does that relate to independent schools?
I think the question almost contains its answer, because equitable services is not actually a phrase that's used very much in independent schools, though I think that schools are very concerned about providing equitable services, despite the fact that it's not really part of their vocabulary in that way. I'm not an attorney, and so parents who want guidance in the law, should obviously consult somebody qualified. But what I do know is that there's very little law that guides independent schools in this area of delivering services. And that means that independent schools are generally pretty free to choose their own population and to establish their own rules and the range of accommodations that they're willing to provide. So in a practical sense, that means that the idea of equitable varies significantly from school to school. There are mainstream schools that will work with every family in their community to provide what I think would be reasonably called equitable services in the public school system. And there are schools that really don't see that as part of their mission. And that's an important thing for parents to know up front when they're considering different schools, which ones are willing to accept that schools, that students in their population have a wide range of neurological development and competency, and what schools really prefer to work with a much narrower range of kids. At my last school, we stressed the idea that equitable doesn't mean equal. It means all students get what they need to learn best within certain limits, obviously. So for example, in a social studies class, we might have had two of the 15 students or 18 students sitting on yoga balls instead of chairs because the yoga balls absorbed energy and that helped those kids with attention challenges to focus. And believe me, I could relate to that. So when another kid would come in and say, hey, why don't I get a ball to bounce on? Our answer was always, do you need a ball? And we found that that kind of openness to discussing our approach instead of shutting it down and saying, you know, just sit down, you don't need it, would allow kids to make good decisions in most cases. And more broadly, it communicated to our community that equitable is our concept above equal. We were really interested in helping kids get what they needed so that kids who had different needs didn't feel like their needs made them odd or dysfunctional in general or something like that. But that's not the case at every school. And some schools do avoid non-neurotypical kids, and some cultures favor uniformity more than others do. I wouldn't say there's anything inherently wrong with these approaches, but I think it underscores the idea that parents really need to ask and observe at any school they would consider for their kids. And I think I'll talk a little bit more later about the intersection of the application process and an individual student's needs.
Right. And I like how you said that in terms of observing and asking those questions. And I say that often to families that I work with and support in terms of if they're looking for a different lens or educational opportunity, to go out and observe, you know, your kids best, and to see what makes most sense for you guys and where you could feel your child would fit in and where your child feels that they could most fit in. I think that's pretty key. Let me ask you though, public schools provide IEPs and 504s, right? So that's federally mandated. It's the law. So how is that translated? And I think you really kind of answered this a bit, but how would that be translated into independent schools? Is that more of a formal term? Is it dependent on each school? What would a parent expect when they're looking at kind of almost comparing the resources that are provided at both ends?
Right. I think that's important because an IEP or a 504 is really the language, the lexicon that we use to talk about learning plans. Most independent schools would definitely welcome an IEP or a 504 from a previous school, and it would serve as a roadmap to serving a student and accommodating that student. But that said, independent schools aren't under an obligation to follow any kind of state mandate or state prescription plan, which, as you said, that's what a 504 is. The state or the federal government is essentially codifying the approach to the child. And as a state actor, a school then is required to follow it. So in an independent school, in most cases, a learning specialist or a learning coordinator, generally the same job, sometimes called different things, would sit down with a family before school begins to discuss the ways that that plan might translate to the school environment. So where a public school has a pullout, for example, for working on reading with a third grader who's struggling, an independent school might decide to do a pullout also, or they might decide not to. They might decide to have somebody in the class, or they may have a great third grade teacher who has worked very successfully with kids in the past. And I think it's fair for parents to to expect that if their child has a 504 or an IEP, that the school will talk about how that translates to their environment. They're not going to get necessarily a formalized learning plan in the same way. But I think the school obviously has an interest in approaching a child with interventions that would be, that they believe would be effective. I think it's really important for families to discuss these considerations during the application process. And it's not actually unusual for an admission office during applications to suggest a meeting between a prospective family and a learning specialist. And it's important for families to know that the learning specialist is, if not always, certainly very often a member of the admission committee for that very reason. To be able to say to the admission committee, yeah, our third grade program can meet this student's needs within the available resources and faculty that we have, or to say, no, this is really outside our range and I think this would be a risk. While I think parents generally don't ever want to hear that their child may not be well served, it's certainly better to hear that before admission than afterwards. I think that there are things worse than being rejected, and one would be matriculating at a school that can't serve your child's needs, obviously.
And I think you really just put this valid point out there, because parents are often really anxious or nervous to come forward with a learning need sometimes because they're set on applying to a particular school. Right? They really want their child to be part, whether it's a legacy school or for whatever reason, they want their child to be part of this community, this learning environment. And so that question has come up, and I appreciate you answering and speaking on that is, you know, what point should they share their child's learning needs, but to come and be upfront with it, to ensure that everybody's on the same page to support this student prior to starting a school, becoming comfortable, and then realizing this is not a good fit and starting to struggle?
It's a question that I deal with all the time. I think that there are neurotypical kids who have neuropsych reports and their parents think, oh, should we be sharing this? And then there are non-neurotypical kids for whom background information is really critical. And I think you raise a question that I have dealt with before, which is that parents have their mind set on a school or one of two schools. And I can often see that that school and that student are not likely to be a very good match. And so over many years of doing this, I've tried to come up with ways to say that gently and non-judgmentally to parents by saying, for example, your child's test scores don't match the scores of the students that they've been admitting for the past few years, which I think is really factual, but conveys that information. But there are also times where kids are qualified for admission at mom's previous school. And I think in those cases, I try to state my case and then let them make their decision. It's not my decision, and I try to keep that in mind. But back to the substance of the question you asked, when to disclose or discuss some of that information, it doesn't really have a single answer. So I often start with families on what they must provide to a school. And the first thing they must be, of course, is honest. I think that to give an answer that is not really a candid response to a question is a mistake, because you don't ever want to start a relationship with anybody, including a school or a school representative, in which you're not being honest. I don't think that's a very good way to start. So I'm not a lawyer, as I said, and parents should consult counsel if they have questions, but having worked for many years in schools and having read approximately 1 zillion neuropsych reports and having read applicants' files all over the place, my understanding is that neuropsych reports are protected both by HIPAA and by FERPA, which is the Federal Educational Records Protection Act, and those tests belong to the parents until a child reaches age 18. And that means parents aren't obligated to release a neuropsych report to a school. That said, I don't see a lot of sense in withholding information from a school. It's hard to see how that would benefit a student. And the application process is generally the time that I encourage parents to discuss this with the relevant school staff. The discussions, as I said, can be pretty nuanced, and they depend on other factors as well. Does other testing, other standardized testing, roughly concur with the neuropsych report? If a neuropsych report says a child is severely dyslexic, but the child is scoring in the 75th percentile, that's a mismatch and it's hard to explain. And in cases like that, there may be reasons not to submit a report. What do teachers say about the student's schoolwork? If teacher recs are really strong, it may be that the student has developed effective approaches to succeed at their grade level that can help lend context to the information in the neuropsych report. And that's a place where I can work with a teacher to make sure that a teacher rec is, of course, honest, but really explains how a student has become an effective participant in English class despite her dyslexia or something like that. And there are also cases where a report will contain sensitive family information. Most of those reports begin literally with birth, with Mrs. McGillicuddy delivered her daughter, Roxana, in a normal term pregnancy. But there are cases where that information is not typical and families would prefer not to discuss all of those things with the school now that the daughter is in 10th grade or something. And often an evaluator will be willing to produce a condensed report that aligns those details but still contains the relevant educational prose. So I can't really give an answer that applies to every family, but I do encourage parents to be candid about what challenges their children face and how they can work with the school to support students if they matriculate there. I think it's really important to consider what a role honesty plays in this process and that you can work with a consultant or you can follow your instincts, but at some point to say, these are my child's strengths and these are my child's weaknesses is usually a valuable piece of information to share with an admission office at the time that sort of feels right to that family.
What would be your advice to families and professionals that may be listening to us today in terms of reaching out to you or starting this process of identifying schools that would work for them? What, all your fabulous years of experience, what would be the best advice?
Well, I think first it's important to say that all of my fabulous experience comes from the fact that not every year of my experience was fabulous. And I think like everybody who's done something for a long time, I learned from my mistakes. So as I've gotten older, I think my expertise has grown, but it's come at a cost, as I think most of us would say. Again, kidding aside, I think there are a lot of families who apply successfully to schools without the help of consultants. I'm quite sure of that, in fact. And if this isn't too shameless a plug, I have dedicated several pages of my own website to offer advice on just how to do this. Here's how to do it yourself if you don't want to use me. I feel like I can do that because there's no way to exhaust the information out there. There's always a question that I haven't anticipated. And every family I work with has a question or an approach that I haven't considered before, which is part of what keeps this exciting. But I think the answer about should you use a consultant begins to move a little bit from no, you don't need it to yeah, that's probably a good idea, the more subtleties and questions arise for you. Most of us in the business that I do, that is consulting on finding schools and helping parents apply to schools, will offer those services on a soup to nuts basis where I charge a flat fee. I think most people work this way. We begin in the fall. We look at a very comprehensive process of identifying schools, thinking about standardized testing, preparing for visits and interviews, both for students and their parents, providing feedback on crafting successful applications and all that kind of process-oriented work. But I also work on an hourly basis with families who want to discuss one aspect of the application, or you have very specific questions and need, you know, I really just need an hour to ask you these five questions. And I'm happy to do that as well. And I think most people in this business will do that. The application process sort of feels unknowable. And I think it's kind of like trying to figure out baseball if you've never seen baseball. Like you can see that there's a logic to it, but the logic is a little bit elusive. So the rules aren't unknowable, they're just unfamiliar because parents generally have not spent their lives peering into this particular rabbit warren. And like a good attorney, a good consultant knows things about the process that parents don't know, and that knowledge is usually valuable. But I think the most important thing of all of this, if parents do want to consider a consultant, is to find the right consultant. And I encourage parents to speak with two or three people in the area to find out which understand what the parents are trying to achieve, which consultants will give candid feedback, even if it's not what parents want to hear. Parents need to know that school's a reach for your kid. And I'm never going to say don't apply there, but I think the odds are low and you need to know that. And I think who resonates most with a parent on the intangibles, who shares a sense of humor, who's easy to talk to, who gets back to you, you know, within 24 hours every time and so forth. And I think parents should ask for references. Anytime a parent asks for references, my response is to find out what grade level they're looking at and send them a reference of somebody who's applied to kindergarten, who's applied to sixth grade, who's applied to ninth or 10th or 11th grade, and who's worked with me on those, because those applications are different for every kid who applies, neurotypical, non-neurotypical, boys, girls, not boys or girls, and any people who are looking to undertake this process. But I think it's important in the end to remember we're all in this for a same goal, which is to help children find and gain acceptance to schools where they will mature and thrive. I don't think that I can guarantee that. I don't think anybody can guarantee that. But I think that what we're good at doing in the consultant business is helping parents present their children in the very best light, in the way that's most effective for the considerations that admission committees at any given school have and how they're likely to view those kids.
Absolutely. And it's so important to know all that. And what a pleasure to chat with you on this process that can be very overwhelming for parents. And I really like how you tilted it in terms of, you know, it's not something that parents do on a daily basis. So it's just learning the process and honing in on what that looks like for each of their kiddos. And, you know, the goal is to help all of our kiddos grow to be the best versions of themselves. And just like all of us, we're unique with strengths and needs. So it's really critical to acknowledge those strengths and needs and really determine the best way to communicate that in a way that provides success for both students, family, and the schools themselves that they're applying to and that they're going to be a part of.
I think that's exactly right. In each area of expertise in the world, in each of our professions, we try to make what we do accessible to other people, but we also speak our own language. Just like a lawyer knows the language of the court system, I think educational consultants know the language of schools. And so we can often help parents translate what they know about their wonderful kids, not into necessarily the best interview or the best application essays or the best of anything. But I like to draw the distinction between the best and the most effective. We know how schools work and how schools look at families that come in. And I see my job as helping parents and families and kids to present themselves in ways that are going to be resonant with schools, to communicate what it is that my experience says schools want to see in the most honest and effective way possible.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for sharing this knowledge and for spending time with us today and to helping guide parents through this process and help navigate and translate that information to really help them be successful in a school that will help them blossom in the way that they should grow and blossom, which then ultimately helps them move to become adults and move through life and work effectively as humans. So that's our end goal, right?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of a pet issue. And so now that we've just done this, maybe I'll send parents running for the exits. But I think what you just said is really important, that we all go into this wanting our kids to be happy. But in schools, I think what we want is for our kids to mature and to thrive. And if parents remember that happiness isn't the goal is maturity, which allows kids then to develop their own happiness. When they find schools that allow their kids to thrive and to mature, that's likely to be a more effective long-term tool for happiness and success than trying to make our kids happy. That's a little bit of a fool's errand, I think. And the path to happiness is not necessarily to make your kids happy. It's to allow them to develop tools by which they can find their own happiness. And finding a good school match is a pretty good step on that process.
And what a gift to provide them with that opportunity.
I think so.
Well, thank you so much. I loved every minute of this. It was so helpful, and I really appreciate your time today.
Thank you for joining us today for our IEP Essentials Pro Tips podcast. To hear more pro tips and find additional IEP Essentials, including our IEP webinar, please visit www.learningessentialsedu.com.